this wide, wonderful world, three distinct kinds of people. There are those who make things happen. There are those who watch things happen. And there are those who say, "What happened?" And the question I have for you tonight is, what group are you? Now, I'm speaking tonight to the people under the age of 20. The rest of you can listen if you want to. But our group tonight are the ones here that are still in school. Which group are you in? Let me tell you a little story. In the climactic portion of the Civil War, General Robert E. Lee did one of those things that he was so equipped to do, being, I think, still probably the finest military mind that this country ever produced. He took his whole 70,000-man Army of Northern Virginia and dived into the cover of the Blue Ridge Mountains. And he just seemed to disappear for a while. And the Federals didn't know where the man had gone. They were terribly worried about him, and they had good reason to be. But he disappeared for a little while. It seemed as if from the face of the earth. Well, under cover of the Blue Ridge Mountains, he took his army and he worked steadily northeastward until he was deep inside Union territory, well northwest of Washington, D.C. And when he finally burst out of the mountains and appeared in the open, he was northwest of a little crossroads town called Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. He headed back southeast, headed toward Washington, D.C., and he was going to present a problem that the Union Army couldn't ignore. So as his gray and butternut uniforms headed southeast, General Meade with the Army of the Potomac headed northwest, and those two powerful forces butted heads at that little Pennsylvania crossroads town. Now, the Union Army went into position along a line of heights that began up at the town of Gettysburg and hooked around in a big circle and then came down kind of in a southwesterly direction, ending in a little twin pair of hills called Little Round Top and Big Round Top. And way down at the southern end of the line, right on Little Round Top, there was a man who hadn't chosen war as his profession. His name was Chamberlain. He was a colonel in the Union Army, but in reality what he was a religion teacher from Bowdoin College up in Maine. Found himself unwillingly thrust into a war he didn't ask for, but was very much involved in. And with a very few hundred troops under his command, he began setting up his line of defense way down there on that little pile of rocks that the Confederates were looking up at. Well, along came his superior officer, and he said, "Colonel Chamberlain, we have reason to fear that the Confederate attack will be up this valley here. What they're probably going to try to do is to get around the end of the army, get behind the Union army, and if they do, if this flank is turned, they will be behind the entire Union army. They will destroy us from the rear. We will probably lose this army, and we probably will lose the war. Now, Colonel, here are your orders. Look to your right, and you will see mile after mile of blue uniforms. They stretch for miles all the way up around the fish hook, all the way to Gettysburg. Look to your left, sir, and you will see nothing. You are the flank. You are the end of the line. If they get around you, the chances are this country will lose the war." Well, it happened about the way they feared it would. Chamberlain got his men in position, and up that draw came row after endless row of gray uniforms, just spitting fire. And for an attack or two, Chamberlain's men held the lines, but pretty soon the lines began to extend around to their left. The Confederates were probing, looking for where that end was that they could circle around, and Chamberlain had to take his thin forces and stretch them like a rubber band. Finally, he had to turn his line and face the oncoming Confederate forces. And as attack after attack occurred, as men began to fire over rifle barrels that were shimmering with heat. Now, I've seen that happen myself. I've seen men light cigarettes off a 5-inch gun barrel off the coast of Vietnam. We fired that many rounds. Well, when you fire that hot and heavy, ultimately something happens. You run out of ammunition. And so it happened. Pretty soon the men in Chamberlain's command were beginning to say, "Colonel, sir, we are out of ammunition. I'm down to 2. I'm down to 5 or 6. What are we going to do if they hit us again?" And when finally his troops had nothing left to shoot, the colonel was in a situation where the only sensible thing you can do is what's called an orderly retreat. It really takes the form of saying, "Feet, don't fail me now." The problem was that if Colonel Chamberlain gave up his position, the flank would be turned, the army would be enveloped, and the war would be lost. Well, he did the only other thing available to him. He said, "We can't shoot at them, so there's no sense standing here. The only other thing we can do is attack. Fix your bayonets. We're going out over the top of these logs. Going out of the trenches. We're going to attack. We got one thing going for us, men. We're going downhill. Gravity's going to be a help." And so it was. And as the next wave of gray and butternut began coming up that mountain, they were astonished to see Federal troops exploding over the parapet. Muskets aim just about the level of your navel coming down in a wall of steel. Now, when you see something like that, you have to ask yourself, do those people know something we don't? Do they have reinforcements? Nobody would be nutty enough to attack unless they did. And you know what the Confederates did? They turned around and they said, "Feet, don't fail us now." And very, very large numbers of them were captured that day. The end of the line was held. The battle was won. And very probably the Union was saved because of a religion teacher and a handful of what essentially were kids on a very hot summer day in the middle 1860s. Now, no doubt it has already occurred to you, what on earth does this have to do with you sitting in a lovely, comfortable place in Oklahoma well over 100 years later? The point I want to make is that just like Chamberlain and his soldiers, you too find yourselves in a war. You didn't ask to be here, you're just here. And by some strange turn of events, the war you're in is starting to heat up. Heat up very, very rapidly. Let me give you a few illustrations of the war you're in. You see it almost weekly from the news media. For example, here's Time magazine of just 1 year ago with the benign, smiling visage of a fine gentleman over in Japan who got the bright idea it might be nice to fill the subways with poison gas. Now, that strikes a little closer to home when you've been there. I've been on those subways in Tokyo and Yokohama. I've been on the mass transit over there. And Japan always prided itself as being one of the most crime-free areas in the world. And suddenly you can't get on a public train without the fear of mass execution. Well, here's another one that comes a little closer to home. This one we remember all too well, just a year ago in Oak City. Part of the war we find ourselves in today. Here's one a little broader. This one, Time magazine chose to do a cover article called "Nuclear Terror for Sale." It's kind of a weird cover, but you can't write about nuclear terror in any other way than weird. Now, the problem that you see behind a headline like this is that the war that is coming looking for you, probing to get around your defenses to envelop this world in something pretty bad, also has taken the form now of leakage of weaponry from what used to be the Soviet Union. Now, when I was on active duty as a naval officer chasing these guys and trying to do dirty tricks on them and they on us, we learned to respect each other. My Russian adversaries were very worthy opponents, very, very bright, very skilled at making weapons. The one advantage we had during the Cold War was at least we knew where the weapons were. We knew where the missile silos were. We had them plotted down to geographic coordinates. The problem we have today is we don't know where the weapons are because there is no Soviet Union any longer to hold all this stuff together. And so we're beginning to see now the danger of this stuff leaking out into the hands of people who are less responsible even than the old Soviet adversaries used to be. I'll give you one very quick example. I think it's quite clear to me from the information we have that probably at least 6 Soviet nuclear warheads are already in the hands of people in the Middle East. 4 of them seem to be in the hands of the Iranians, and 2 of them seem to be in the hands of the Syrians. One of them is an artillery shell. It was designed to be fired by Russian artillery. Nobody there has that kind of a gun, so that one is only dangerous if they can take it apart and put it back together in another form. Another one, however, is an aerial bomb that's hung on the wing of an aircraft that's based in the Shiraz Air Base in southwestern Iran. We know the thing is there. We have tracked it on radar. It has this bomb hung on its wing. It's either a MiG or Sukhoi 27, and its flight radius can cover much of the Middle East, including the Persian Gulf and much of Saudi Arabia. So tonight, there are lots of things that are really worrying a lot of people who are in high places and who understand the information that's coming down. By the way, folks, as the next newscaster, I'm going to make an admission that probably you'll only hear from me. And that is, when you watch the news, you don't get all the news. You understand? I dare say most of you have never heard Tom Brokaw or Dan Rather. You know, Dan was in getting into the news business back when I was in it. I was back when Dave Brinkley was still doing Anchor Network News. Well, Dan and some of the other guys were fairly young broadcast reporters back in those days. They aren't telling stories like this, I suspect, because the implications are so scary, they're worried about mass hysteria. But the simple, ugly fact is that what used to be the Soviet Union is hemorrhaging very dangerous stuff out into the world, and hence once in a while get a hint of it in a magazine article, something like this. That's part of the war you find yourself embroiled in. Put all this witch's brew together, stir it up real thoroughly, and you come up with an ugly four-letter word called fear, and there is Pat Buchanan on the cover of Newsweek, glowering, you know, in a very, very suggestive way at you, as though, you know, there's not much left of the world. And what does the headline say on that particular cover story? Preaching fear. Why? America's listening. A lot of concerned people. Now, that is the war you find yourself in. And at this point, I think it would be appropriate to open the Word. So I invite you to join me in the book of Luke. Luke chapter 21. And we'll begin here with verse 10. You know, Luke 21 and Matthew 24 and Mark 13 are nothing more than Jesus' answer to a very good question. His disciples on the Mount of Olives very privately say, Lord, what's this world going to look like just before you return the second time? Well, his answer to that question is to be found in those 3 chapters of the Bible, and we're looking at one of them right now. Luke 21, beginning with verse 10. Then he said unto them, Nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and great earthquakes shall be in diverse places, and famines, and pestilences, and fearful sights. Now, let's skip on over here to verse 25. And there shall be signs in the sun, moon, and stars, and upon the earth distress of nations with perplexity, men's hearts failing them for what? For this animal right here on the cover of Newsweek magazine, that four-letter word called fear. In other words, there's going to come a time in which a lot of people are going to look at the world, put two and two together, and say, hey, folk, this is getting just a little bit dicey. That's the war you find yourselves in. Now, why would the Lord have positioned a group of young people like yourselves in that kind of circumstance where you're facing those kind of challenges? Why would he put you there? Real simple answer. He put you there because you are the best there is. And come any better. Why are you the best? Why does the Lord count so heavily on teenagers, on very young adults, on young people? Well, number one, you're the best there is because you are a teenager. Now, hear me well, folk. There is nothing in this world better. There is no mind in this world better than a teenage mind. You understand me? You know, adults, as the mileage begins to rack up on the odometer, get to the point where they have pretended so long, I honestly don't think they know when they're pretending and when they're not. That's what I like about kids. You know, they still are pretty open with what their feelings are. They see things pretty clearly. If I could try a case in court to the dream jury, now you've heard about the dream team, you've seen that in action. Well, if I could pick a dream jury, you know what it would be? Nobody over 19. You know why? Because your brains still work good. Just as simple as that. You know something else? I was kind of embarrassed, and I think a lot of people were rather put off by the American legal system recently during the O.J. Simpson trial when we saw the way lawyers behaved in court. Do you know why they were acting like such perfect fools? Because they had adults on the jury. I'm serious. If they had had teenagers up there, they'd have never gotten by with it. They would have been laughed out of court. They would have had to have cleaned up their act and made sense. Okay? There is nothing better than a teenage mind. You folk cut through the baloney and you get to the issue, and you don't have to hear it twice. You get it the first time. I like the teenage mind. So does the Lord. Okay? That's why you're here. The Lord needs the best. Now, point number two, you're in this position, this strategic position of the war, not only because you're a teenager. You got something else going for you. You know what it is? You're an Adventist teenager. That means there's nothing better on planet Earth. Nothing burns me up more than to see visiting speakers talk down to an Adventist teenage audience as though they've already made their minds up that the best you're good for is being entertained for a few minutes, and when they're done, they'll, you know, flee off someplace else. You know, I don't believe in talking down to young minds, folk. You talk up to them because they're capable of handling information. Now, you're an Adventist teenager. As such, you already know more about this world and what the future holds than most adults will ever learn all their lives. You understand that? Let me give you some examples of what I mean. Let's go back and let's talk about these magazine covers we just looked at. You know, the cult of doom in Japan, the sad events in Oak City, this nuclear terror issue, and Pat Buchanan's ability to turn fear into an election year issue. What do these things all say to us? What they say is we're facing a situation in which the average adult mind is beginning to feel real concern. And the solutions they're coming up with don't make sense. Let me read you one proposed solution here. And let me get out from behind this pulpit, because I'm not a preacher, I'm a lawyer. Here is a letter to the editor that came out in my hometown newspaper right after the bombing here in Oak City. Here's one person's reaction. By the way, I think that Bakersfield, California, really could be properly classified as a western suburb of Oklahoma City. You know that? Really, very seriously, we have lots and lots of people from Oklahoma who live there, and so I think probably that what I'm going to read to you is very similar to what you might hear in the newspaper here. He said, "Being witness to the recent horror in Oklahoma City, I am prompted to think about what has gone so wrong. I remembered how I spent my growing up years every Sunday going to church. We can return to that part of our past, and it would be so simple. Every business was closed on that day to honor the Sabbath. We could do that now. We would then have no choice but to invent ways to enjoy Sunday with our family and friends. There is wisdom in the commandment, honor the Sabbath day." Now, there's a solution being proposed by an adult. And Adventist teenagers are going to immediately know it's the wrong solution, but the average adult is not. You already know more than the average population. Let me give you another example of why I think you're so important. Here's a little Christian American tabloid. It's a little newspaper put out by the Christian Coalition. And they're hard at work again, because the last time we had an election 2 years ago, they completely revolutionized the House and Senate and made it a Republican majority very successfully. Well, there are a lot of good people in the Christian Coalition. All they're concerned about are safe neighborhoods and decent stuff on TV and morality and the future of their own kids. These aren't bad people trying to do bad things. These are good people, the kind of folk you'd like to live next door to, trying to save this country. But their solution is wrong, folk. Because on the back page of that little newspaper is a picture and a caption. Now, there's nothing wrong with a picture. That's General Washington kneeling in the snow, probably at Valley Forge, in the dark hours of the Revolution, in which it looked like we probably weren't going to make it as an independent country. And he's kneeling in prayer beside his war horse. There is nothing wrong with that picture. Every patriotic American, I think, could appreciate having that on your wall. What bothers me is the little headline that our well-meaning friends have put over the picture. And it reads, "When prayer was legal, mandatory, and part of our nation's armor." When prayer was what? Mandatory. Now, I know a little bit about constitutional law, and I'm telling you something. In terms of U.S. constitutional law, prayer never has been mandatory, because there's this thing called the First Amendment that says Congress shall pass no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And yet a lot of people looking at a very, very mixed up world and a mixed up country are starting to say maybe it's time to surrender liberty and have something mandatorily imposed on the public. When prayer was can you folks think of any time in human history when prayer was mandatory? Sure you can. Anybody here studied European history during the Middle Ages? Ever heard of a thing called the Inquisition? Prayer was mandatory. You want to go back to those days? You know what it was like to live in the Inquisition? Dark of night, a knock comes on your door. There is an armed guard. You are escorted without benefit of anybody else being there to a secret proceeding at an inquisitor's office. There are no witnesses, there is no public, there is no press, and there are no lawyers present, and you've got no Bill of Rights. And you are required to give answers to questions. There's no Fifth Amendment that says that you can be protected from self-incrimination. And when you get done making a confession under those circumstances, oftentimes what awaits you is the rack or the stake. Prayer was mandatory back in those days. Folk, you want to go back? I don't. So here are solutions that people are coming up with. Let me give you another example of the solutions that we're seeing. I should probably tell you that I'm a member of a number of Catholic organizations. Let me share something here with you. I sometimes do this just to show how I got involved in all of this stuff. I am a card-carrying charter member of the Catholic Campaign for America. There's my name. Helped to start the organization. You know why? Because I want to know what these people are saying and what they're thinking and what they're planning. Somebody needs to know. Might as well be me, I guess. I'm a member of something called the Catholic League for Religious and Civil Rights. Current dues-paying member of this. I get their material sometimes 2 and 3 times a month. I get all kinds of mail in my mailbox addressed, "Dear Fellow Catholic." And I find out all kinds of interesting stuff from these people. Now, one of the things that I got recently from them was a congressional scorecard that's designed to help us decide who gets elected and who gets defeated this coming November. And here is what they say. A strong alliance between America's evangelical Christians and conservative Catholics is critical to reversing the steep moral and spiritual slide in America. By working together, conservative Catholics and Protestants will make America great again by restoring her moral strength. By working how? Working together. That's the goal. Now, that will help you understand some of the headlines you see. Here's one from Corpus Christi, from the Collar Times newspaper down there, just about a year and a half ago. And the headline says, Baptists embrace ties with Catholics. And one of their seminary deans in the Southern Baptist Convention says, we live in a land where there is a demonic onslaught against the forces of decency and righteousness, and we need to stand with good people together. Now, folk, that isn't the classic mark of the beast thing, you know, where we always imagine we would see the end of time coming, you know, great big float coming down Main Street with 666 written across the front, and the Pope up there shaking holy water on everybody. And we always imagine when it happened, you know, then I'm going to know, yeah, I may have played around with religion a little bit, you know, I may have been a California Adventist for a while, but when I see that happen, I'm going to straighten my life out, I'm going to be ready to see Jesus come. And folk, it isn't happening that simply, is it? It's happening so subtly that you don't even feel it coming, and all of a sudden we wake up one morning and here's Time magazine on December 26, 1994, naming His Holiness, quote unquote, as the Man of the Year. In which Billy Graham, no less, says, and I quote, he, the Pope, has been the strong conscience of the whole Christian world. Now, good people doing what they think will help the world, and this is the result. Now, where do you come in, the Adventist teenagers, the foot soldiers standing in the face of that juggernaut of the forces of history attacking? Where do you come in? You come in because you already know what's wrong with the world, and you know what's wrong with the proposed solution. You can't combine church and state. See, you come in because you have read things like this from Great Controversy, page 599. The Protestants of the United States will be foremost in stretching their hands across the Gulf to clasp hands with the Roman power. And in volume 5, page 451, she says, when Protestantism shall stretch her hand across the Gulf to grasp the hand of Roman power, then we may know that the end is near. Now, with those words kind of ringing around there in that cranial cavity, you know, echoing a little bit, let me read you a headline from a Southern California newspaper from March 30, just 2 years ago. And the headline reads, Catholics and Evangelicals Join Hands. Join what? Join hands. Ellen White says, when you see it happen, the end is near. We're seeing it in the headlines, and we're seeing it in pictures now. There's a picture that appeared in my hometown newspaper. Not too many months ago, after one editorialist had gone through digesting what's going on in the world today and kind of trying to put it together and make sense of it, he drew a picture, which I think you can see reasonably clearly, of Uncle Sam with his Stars and Bars top hat reaching across the North Atlantic to shake hands with a gentleman in the full regalia of the Pope of Rome. Now, that is where the world is obviously trying to go. But as a young Adventist, you know there's something wrong in that picture. As nice as it looks to see Christians shaking hands and trying to reunite, you understand there's something wrong with that simply because the Bible and Spirit of Prophecy have said that that's where we're going to make our big terminal mistake in this world at the end of time. Interestingly enough, it's possible to prove from very recent documents that when you find a problem with these reunifications of the Christian church, there is something really there to worry about. You're not just being an old-fashioned Victorian Adventist who hasn't yet been dragged kicking and screaming into the 20th century. There's still something to worry about here. Let me show you Exhibit A. I got in my hand here a little booklet called The Reign of Christ the King. It was written by an English Catholic, very, very sincere, very committed gentleman, very fine Christian, I'm sure, but with some conclusions that I strongly disagree with. Because he's suggesting it's time to abolish the wall of separation between church and state, and let's go back to a world in which the function of government is to support one church, one true church, one Catholic church. This was written in 1992, so it's very, very recent, and it reflects the thinking that you will find among conservative Catholics today. Let me just share with you a couple of excerpts from it. He says that the separation of church and state was condemned by the Roman pontiffs. The church's teaching is that the state has an obligation to render public worship to God in accordance with the teachings of the true church, the Catholic Church, and positively to aid the Catholic Church in carrying out her functions. The state does not have the right to remain neutral. Well, in case that point hasn't made itself relatively clear, let me read you one more from page 27 of his book. And here's what he says. Anything less than Catholicism will not stand up in the long run. So it is we Catholics who actually hold the key both to the social reign of Christ and to the saving of our civilization. We must therefore work toward the day when the governments of the world will recognize Christ, His Catholic Church, and His Holy Law. 1992. As a young Adventist, you would have something to say about talk like that. You'd be able to point people, for example, to Revelation 14, verses 8 through 10, that talks about a terminal challenge at the end of time when a lot of scared people, a lot of otherwise good people, make a terrible mistake, try to put the world together on one single religious footing, and wind up with the worst crisis in liberty the world has ever seen. You'd have one more thing to say, and I want to close with that. And that would be a day called Sabbath, the seventh day. Not too long ago, Pat Robertson, one of the heads of the Christian Coalition, wrote a book called The New World Order. And in his book, he said this, "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Our minds, our spirits, and our bodies demand a regular time of rest. Perhaps God's greatest gift to mankind's earthly existence is the ability to be free from work one day a week. I never gave the issue of a day of rest much thought until I read Isaiah when he said, if you turn your foot away from the Sabbath, from doing your pleasure on my holy day, and call the Sabbath a delight, then you shall delight yourselves in the Lord, and I will cause you to ride on the high places of the earth." Well, Pat Robertson concluded that by saying, after reading Isaiah's talk about the Sabbath, I determined to remake my Sundays according to the biblical model. Now, we've seen this thing coming for well over 100 years, folk, and it's trying to happen in the world we live in. As a matter of fact, as recently as May 21, 1995, a Catholic priest, the parish priest for St. Catherine's Parish up in Michigan, sent a little newsletter around to his parishioners. And in the front page of that thing, he embedded the following comment about the Sabbath and about the authority of the Roman Catholic Church. And he put it in this language. "Perhaps the boldest thing the Church ever did was to change the holy day, the Sabbath, from Saturday to Sunday. The day of the Lord, Dies Dominica, was chosen not from any directions noted in the Scripture, but from the Church's sense of its own power. People who think that the Scriptures should be the sole authority should logically become Seventh-day Adventists and keep Saturday holy." End of quote, and I say to the good father, amen. I think you finally said something I can agree with. But interestingly enough, in another document I got from some of my Catholic friends in Rome, I find a calendar specifically engineered so that Sunday winds up as the seventh day of the week. Things are moving much more rapidly, I think, than we sometimes realize. Do you folk, as young Adventists, have anything of significance to say? It would interest you, perhaps, to note that if you do not say what you have to say, then other voices will say it. I've got in my book here, now I should say in my hand here, a book called The Thunder of Justice. Very, very new book by some very, very committed, very sincere Catholic writers. And here in part is what their book has to say. See if the language sounds familiar to you. We are confronted today by an ocean of events. The wiping out overnight of mighty empires, terrible wars, waves of torture and persecution on all five continents. We are in what Christ emphasized as those telltale signs of the times. Where have we heard that term before? Yet our Catholic friends are using it. Let me give you a couple more examples. The battle now being waged in the heavens will soon be played out in awesome fury before our eyes. The final battle is coming soon, and the remnant will survive, but they will be small in number. Now, we've heard about the signs of the times. Now they're using a term like remnant. Does that sound familiar? On page 8 of their book, they say, 16 years ago, Pope Paul VI said he saw a definite pattern of events unfolding, which gave him concern that these might be the, well, you want to finish the sentence, folk? End times. Okay? Does that term sound familiar? Now let me give you one more. They say in all ages there have been persons possessed of the spirit of prophecy. End of quote. All from a Catholic book. Folk, what we do not say will be said by others. The war is very, very near its end. And whether you like it or not, my young friends, you find yourselves right there at the end of the line. It's that canyon you're looking down where the enemy is advancing. Why has the Lord put you there? Very simple reason. God needs the best. Now, there's some older people, you know, that are going to stand on that same battle line. But folk, the Lord can't do it just with old folks. Now, there's a certain hazard inherent in getting old. I'm beginning to discover that. It gets to the point where everything hurts, you know, and what doesn't hurt doesn't work. All right? Now, the Lord can use older people, and He will. I mean, we need their experience. We need what they know, what they've learned. But we can't win the war without the young. We need the best. What God needs right now is the first team, the best there is. And so I suggest to you that perhaps, like Colonel Chamberlain of many years ago, you find yourselves in a place that's going to get very hot very quick. Look to your right, young ladies and gentlemen, and you will see the entire structure of the church, the schools, the institutions, the hospitals, the churches. Goes on for miles all around this wide world. It's all sitting out there. But you look to your left, and you will see nothing. You are the flank. You are the end of the line. And if the enemy gets around you, I fear we will lose this wonderful opportunity. Shall we close with prayer? Heavenly Father, give us the sense to see when opportunity is staring us in the face, and that a time of danger is also always a time of huge opportunities. Help us take advantage of them, we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.